We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Yes, a long time ago, Lyndon Johnson. Well, the night of November 8, 2016, sent people across America into a state of shock. How could the Democrats lose to this terrible, awful, incredibly immature, rather disgustingly behaved individual who had no understanding of the traditional and proper role of government? Of course, that stunning moment has given way to a lengthy period of introspection for Democrats. It's probably been needed for a long time. Many feel that the loss has done terrible things to America, but there's no question it has shaken the Democrats out of decades of acquiescence. And as painful as big change is, there is significant evidence that the necessary change is indeed occurring. We're going to talk about that today. It's not happening easily, nor as quickly as many would like. We are Americans, after all. We want it now. But it is happening, state by state. Here to talk about this countrywide move toward a reinvigorated party, one dedicated to the old-fashioned Democratic principles espoused by Bernie Sanders, is Theo Anderson. Theo, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, let's see. He writes for In These Times, his staff writer, who has contributed to the magazine since 2010 and is currently a Schumann Center writing fellow. He has a Ph.D. in modern U.S. history from Yale and writes on the intellectual and religious history of conservatism and progressivism in these currently United States. You can follow him on Twitter at TheoAnderson7. Well, again, thanks for being with us. A show I did a few weeks ago focused on the division in the Democratic Party, which was touched off on April 4th, 1967, when Martin Luther King made his famous Riverside Church speech, in which he called for Democrats to see the war in Vietnam as a struggle between rich and powerful versus the average person, not just in Vietnam, but all over the world. He called for us to take a stand against imperialism, even if it's led by a Democratic administration. The big divide really started that day. As our guest writes, what we see now, quote, is without doubt the most serious fissure in the party since its centrist and leftist wings came to blows over the Vietnam War in 1968, end of quote. The struggle for identity certainly continues. Clearly, the division now is between a few establishment Democrats and the energy and passion of the Bernie Sanders traditional wing of the party. Where is the energy and the momentum now? You've looked at this in a bunch of different states. Where do you see the energy and momentum, Theo?
As you mentioned, a lot of it has come out of the Bernie Sanders campaign last year, a year ago. The question that I've been really following is, since the campaign folded, what becomes of that energy? So that's become my beat for In These Times. We're a progressive magazine and very interested in the movement, but also in how it manifests in electoral politics. So as I'm sure many of your listeners know, our revolution was founded coming out of the Sanders campaign last September. And so I've been looking at how that is manifesting kind of under the radar in various ways over the last 6 months. A couple of pieces I've done. One is on the Massachusetts Democratic State Convention held in early June. There was a strong showing by the Our Revolution people at that convention. They forced the party to the left on several issues, paid family leave, for example. And Also, $15 minimum wage and single-payer health care. So that was one manifestation. Then another piece I've done is on the California Democratic Party, which had a very contentious convention in late May, very similar to what happened in Massachusetts. It wasn't strictly an R revolution contingent of protesters. It was the Nurses Association have been very involved both in Massachusetts and in California. Some of the delegates who went to the Democratic National Convention last summer were heavily involved in it. So I don't want to say that it's all our revolution. It's pretty broad-based coalition. But so in both cases, the platforms that came out of those conventions were pretty far left, at least in the U.S. context, in terms of minimum wage, things like that. The real sticking point in both conventions is the democratization of the party and how the leadership is elected and making it more open to the grassroots, things like that. So that's, you know, we're at an odd moment where there seems to be a convergence on a pretty far left platform, but the party itself is resisting and kind of reforms of itself.
And what I find interesting is that there are far fewer of them, the establishment. Let's try to figure out how the establishment of the party maintains its hold. At the National Convention, there were the superdelegates who were almost all in lockstep with the establishment. What about at the state levels? How are the delegates currently chosen? Can change be made at the state level? And you discussed a little bit about Massachusetts and California, but you also have written about Colorado, Nebraska, Washington, Wyoming, and Michigan. What's happening there? The large number of people from what I call the traditional wing of the Democratic Party, what Wellstone called the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. What's happening in those states, momentum-wise?
Yeah, in the Western states in particular, the insurgents, the our revolution type people have had some success winning the state chair positions and more the leadership positions. Partly because the parties are more hollowed out in those states, places like Nebraska, Wyoming, Colorado, and so it's just lower hanging fruit in those kinds of states. Now, in a place like Massachusetts, one of the calls for reform was to end the superdelegates. The party sort of was able to resist and send off that challenge. Same was true in California, but that doesn't just go away. Like, that energy is still there, and our revolution people have promised to be back. So I don't want to overstate the extent of reforms because mostly the success has been on pushing policy, but the real anger at the party right now by forces like Our Revolution and allied groups has to do with the corporate character of the Democratic Party and the way that warps its priorities and also warps its leadership style and closes it off to the grassroots base. As everybody knows, the establishment is strong. I mean, it's not going to give up easily, but I think what we can say is that the progressive energies are also stronger than they've been in a long time and more unified and organized. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over the next year or so. I also want to mention, part of this energy is invested in a complete end run around the party. Yeah. And I'm thinking specifically of a couple of organizations that I'm writing a piece on right now, which is Brand New Congress and Justice Democrats, who are planning to run candidates as Democrats. And in the case of Brand New Congress as Republicans, as long as they agree to the platform, which is an extremely progressive platform, they're planning to run their candidates and make them pledge not to take any money from corporate interests, that only individual contributions, and they will provide their own support and structure to allow them to enter the race. So really no contact with the formal Democratic Party, but running, kind of taking over the apparatus of the party and using it for their own purposes, which I think is a really interesting development. I mean, so far, brand new Congress, I think, has about a dozen candidates fielded. They hope, they say 400 is their goal. I think it's more likely to be in the dozens, at least in this cycle. Who knows what they'll do in 2020? It probably depends on how successful they are in 2018. But that kind of energy, invested in kind of a takeover of the party without actually taking over the state parties is a new development and worth keeping an eye on.
Very interesting. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Theo Anderson, who is a staff writer for In These Times. We're talking about the Democratic Party. People, younger people in particular, are... there have been some people calling for, give up on the party. You know, they didn't, they're not the Bernie people. Look what happened in 2016. Millennials specifically, they may have had their first experience in politics in 2016. They were excited and deeply passionate for Bernie Sanders to be the standard bearer. And there were millions of them, tremendous energy. Since the leadership of the Democratic National Committee greased the process for its chosen candidate, Sanders, of course, was denied the nomination. The party leadership designee blew what was expected to be an easy win. We're talking about Hillary Clinton, of course. So today, many of these young people have decided the party is just of no use to them. The party leadership was corrupted by big money powers and has no relevance to them. So they're giving up on being Democrats. But from my experience, political change is quite unlike radio or TV, where you can just flip a switch and the change is made. What can you say to those who may be impatient and unwilling to get involved in the Democratic Party as an agent for what Bernie Sanders called a political revolution? What can you say to them?
Yeah. Well, as you started off by saying, you know, there was a challenge to the Democratic Party, and a pretty serious challenge in the 1960s over the Vietnam War.
Yes.
That faded out, and pretty much the establishment won, I think it's fair to say, in that case. But I think if we look at, let's look at the Republican Party and what happened there. If we want to look at, I think that's our best example of a movement that has successfully taken over a party and had its will. And we're seeing the manifestation of that very much right now. We have for the last several years with the emergence of the Tea Party. But, you know, that Tea Party energy dates, you can date it to several points, but at least to the early 1960s with the John Birch Society and, the challenge, the Barry Goldwater challenge in the 1964 election.
Yep.
So, what can we learn from how the conservative movement took over the Republican Party and made it what it is today? I thought a lot about this, and I'm working on a piece about it, actually. And I think there are several similarities between what happened with the conservative movement and what's going on with the progressive base. And I'll just talk about two or three of them. One is obviously the highly energized base. I mean, the John Birch people and the related far-right groups, extremely energized through the 1960s. And 70s and beyond. Also, they had, I think, what's not talked about as much as really critical is they had kind of a built-in infrastructure with the religious right and its organizations. They kind of got engaged in the 1970s, 1980s, and really took up the Republican cause. The Democratic Party hasn't had that kind of, it's had the labor movement primarily. And we know what's happened to the labor movement over the last few decades.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then also concrete goals. With the Republicans, it's always been cutting taxes, cutting regulations, getting government out of our lives,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. So, I think the experience of the conservative movement and the Republican Party is it doesn't happen immediately,
right.
But it can happen. I mean, they were in it for the long game. 1964, they were absolutely devastated
yep.
in the Goldwater election. You know, 16 years later, they got their man in office, Ronald Reagan, and you know, the agenda didn't get passed overnight, but it did get passed, and we're living with the havoc that it has wrought on the nation. So, like, it's the easiest thing in the world to talk about the corruption of the Democratic Party. We all know it's extremely corrupt.
Yes.
But we also know that it can be changed. Like, any party is always in flux and constantly evolving and changing, just depending on the energies that are channeled into it. So I think, although there's much cause for despair when you think about what the Republican Party has become,
yeah,
and how it's been shaped the way it is, there's also some reason for hope if you're a progressive hoping to change the Democratic Party, because all the elements are there. I mean, one thing about the Sanders Revolution, if you want to call it that, is it's inspired some of the creation of some of this infrastructure that has been missing. I mean,
right,
it's not just our revolution. It's these other groups I've been talking about, Brand New Congress or Justice Democrats, that things that are maybe even hostile to the Democratic Party, but also aligned with progressive goals and willing to work within the political system.
Mm-hmm.
I was just listening to an interview with William Barber, the minister from North Carolina, and he's apparently embarking on the, I think it's the Poor People's Campaign, something to that effect, where it's, I don't think he's particularly enamored of the Democratic Party, but he spoke at a convention last summer, and he's pushing a strong social justice agenda that will work to the Democratic Party to meet its goals. So I think there are lots of reasons, for hope, but the question is how far does hope get you? That remains to be seen.
Yeah, hope kills, but it can be done. And I'm just imagining, in 1964, if the young people who were the Barry Goldwater movement said, "Oh, I give up on the Republican Party,"
yeah,
it took a while. Yes, it takes a while. You got to have a little bit of patience. Got to get involved locally. It can be done. It is being done. What do you say to those who talk about the more cautious Democrats? The argument is that, well, in the red states, the Republican states, candidates will get squashed if they come off as too left, too progressive. My take on the 2016 nominating process is that it was really less about left versus right and more about being for the out-of-touch elite and the regular average income people. My sense is that people in both parties, and independents especially, want their elected officials to be more responsive to the needs of people than the wants of corporate interests, average people. What about the more cautious Democrats? Are they coming around? What do you see? What can be said to them? They sense the average. Do the cautious Democrats sense the average voters are looking for people to stand up for something? What do you say to them?
I mean, we have evidence that Bernie Sanders is the most popular politician in the U.S. right now. There are polls that actually say that. And
right.
I think it's not that everybody agrees with all his policies necessarily, but they do like that he, he speaks his mind. I mean, it's the same kind of, in a bizarre way, people have said that about Trump. I think it's ludicrous that, he's some kind of truth teller. He's willing to say just about anything. That's true.
Yeah.
But that was part of his shtick, that he was willing to say what other politicians weren't. I've written pieces about this. Like, the progressive agenda, every plank in the progressive platform,
mm-hmm,
it polls popularly. Like, 60%
so
plus of Americans agree with every so-called leftist position you can name, with the sole exception of gun control. I mean, gun rights, Americans are still fairly conservative on that.
Yeah.
But, even things that were considered radical a few years ago, like single-payer healthcare, now polls.
People want it.
60% plus. So I don't understand. I mean, and same-sex marriage is shockingly kind of been taken off the table. You don't hear that as a wedge issue in the same way that you did a few years ago. So I'm not sure what is the value in caution? If you're, you know, if you're calling like a progressive gender radical, it's really not, you know, it's pretty mainstream these days with, maybe not $15 minimum wage, but at least $12 minimum wage, single payer healthcare, child care, even, things like free college, is popular. So, and I guess that's the other thing I wanted to say about the experience of Republicans. Like, I feel like in the 70s and 80s, they sort of were at the common sense of the so-called common sense of the nation. Like, people were for, you know, I think tax cuts pulled well, or getting government out of our lives pulled well. Well, we're at a point where things have really turned in a progressive direction just in terms of the common sense of the nation and what people are willing to accept. I think that's a development that's underplayed. And, you know, of course, none of it gets passed because of the nature of our Congress and the corporate influence in our Congress. But a very progressive agenda is actually what people want. You know, if you go by the polling. So I guess that's a long way of saying, you know, I guess in some cases I understand why certain politicians are cautious. I just think if they would, you know, take the leap and present a bold agenda, that they'd be surprised by the results.
Yeah, and I've heard it said that, well, in many states, there's only two things in the middle of the road: yellow stripes and dead animals.
Yeah.
I mean, people want, I do think people really want somebody to stand up in this caution. You know, you keep trying it again and again, and how often does it work? I don't know. We're all aware of what's being called the resistance. I think it's a fabulous thing. If it were just about resisting the insanities of Donald Trump, that would be one thing. But the strength would be diluted, I think, including any and all opposition to Trump's agenda would be less of a powerful force than the resistance really is. Your essay quotes Karen Bernal saying, quote, "The resistance won't be limited to fighting the GOP. Resistance doesn't mean saving the ACA, the so-called Obamacare. It means replacing it with single payer," end of quote. It seems to me this focus on a few passionate issues gives the resistance its real strength. What are the other main issues uniting people working to retake the Democratic Party from the corporate interests?
I think it is the most passionate thing that I hear when I talk to people who are about reforming the Democratic Party is campaign finance reform, getting money out of the party. Like, I went to the People's Summit was held here in Chicago, and I attended a couple of sessions. One was on, you know, getting corporate money out of politics, basically. And the other was transforming the Democratic Party. And as I wrote in one of the essays I did from the summit, you know, they were basically the same session. I mean, like, transforming the Democratic Party is really about getting corporate influence out of it. And, you know, one of the speakers said, this is kind of remarkable, if we had had this session even 5 years ago, we would have had three people, like, and there were 300 at the session on getting corporate money out of politics. It's, you know, ever since Citizens United, it's been pretty well on the radar of progressives, but I think it's emerging now. It's so obscene and so ridiculous, the levels of money and what it's doing to our politics, that really can't be ignored. So that, and I think the other major development is that not only the $15 minimum wage, but single payer health care, Medicare for all, have emerged as kind of the you know, the rallying around points for progressives to push Democrats to the left. That's partly because of the way the Republicans have fumbled the repeal of Obamacare and opened up that debate. It's also about the way Donald Trump kept talking about, you know, we should have health care for everybody, even though the policy he actually supports doesn't do that, of course. But he did talk about that.
Yes.
That's what we need, a system that provides universal health care. So,
and people get,
I don't think he really knows what he was talking about, but he said the words. And so that opened up the debate. So I think those are the three pillars of what's going on, the higher minimum wage, the single-payer health care, and corporate influence. Those yep. have really gotten traction.
And they're really uniting people, people who've never been in it before, but who are making up the resistance, which is very, very powerful, and it just keeps going. I know we have just a few minutes left here. I've heard it said politics and protest, both are necessary, but neither is sufficient. I've been involved in politics and protest for many years, and I've experienced both losing and winning. And I can tell you it's better to win. It really is better to win. Are enough people getting it that protest is one thing, but seizing actual political power can be done. It can be done, not through a third party. The only way to do it is to dig in, to do the hard work, using the structure locally that is already in place. Are people getting that, do you think? I mean, I worry about some people saying, oh, forget the Democratic Party and just start a third party. The Republicans love that.
I think that, as in so many areas, the election of Donald Trump was such a shock to the system that people are getting it more than they would have if Hillary Clinton had been elected.
Yeah.
Mm. And I'm not trying to look for silver linings in Trump's presidency, because it's an unmitigated disaster.
Yes.
But I do think that we're seeing, like, there's such it's such a shock that it sent such shockwaves through our political system that I think people realize that we need both. Like, we have to be, you know, out on the streets rallying, calling congressmen, whatever, all that kind of thing. But we also have to be engaged in actual electoral politics and voting.
Yes.
You know, because, like, it's undeniable now that, you know, who's in, you know, which person wins the presidency or the congressional races. It does make a difference. Like, it makes an actual difference, and it's not just they're not two sides of the same coin. As bad as the Democrats are in many ways, they can be pushed in a better direction. So, it's not going to happen. Probably in 2018, it's not going to happen overnight. But I think there's value in looking at this the way that the conservatives did in the 70s, 80s, as a long game, and that will get us, I think, where we need to be.
Yes, it is. I believe so. Thank you so much, Theo Anderson. If you want to follow his work in these times, I guess, is the place to go. I don't know if there's any other place you'd suggest on that electronic internet thing.
No, In These Times is my primary outlet. So, right. Yeah.
Well, thank
Appreciate
you so much.
The time.
Well, thank you. And it is encouraging. We will be back in just a couple of minutes talking about how we can, or perhaps not, win the war on ISIS. The current way we're doing it doesn't seem to be working. Stay with us.
There's a new world coming near, singing loud and clear, revolution. Feel that rumbling along the ground, it's a mighty sound, revolution. It's the sound of the morning dove, people all joining hands in love, sharing times roll, revolution. Every man, woman, child on earth gets a free rebirth, revolution. Life is love and it's here and now. We want more than the laws allow. Bring us peace and we want. Crushed by sin and war, revolution. You've been living from day to day. Now get out of the way, revolution. Love and freedom for everyone.
Vietnam did not go well, even though we had tremendous military superiority over the Vietnamese. Somehow it didn't go well for us. And there's a lot of anger right now at the ISIS group. But what can we do about it? Confucius said, before you embark on a journey of revenge, dig two graves. One can understand the urge to retaliate for terrorist attacks, but the question we must ask is, does it work? As many have learned from the use of the death penalty, revenge is not the same as justice. It solves nothing, and most often, revenge exacerbates the problem. Very pleased to have with us in Keeping Democracy Today our guest, Professor Andrew Bacevich. Andrew, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you.
And Professor Bacevich, in a recent article, asks, the question is whether further war can provide a remedy to the problem at hand. Professor Bacevich is an historian specializing in international relations, security studies, American foreign policy, and American diplomatic and military history. He knows what he's talking about. He's a professor emeritus at Boston University. Bacevich has been a persistent vocal critic of U.S. occupation of Iraq, calling the conflict a catastrophic failure. In March 2007, he described George W. Bush's endorsement of such preventive wars as, quote, immoral, illicit, and imprudent. Proved to be right. His son, also an Army officer, died fighting in the Iraq War in May 2007. His new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Well, again, thanks for being with us. The problem might appear to be simple, and a solution just as simple. Bomb the hell out of them. Well, as H.L. Mencken said, to every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's wrong. Before we get to ideas for possible solutions, what is the problem at hand, Professor Bacevich?
Well, it's that you're asking the appropriate first order question, and I don't pretend to be able to provide a definitive answer, but it seems to me that the real nexus of the issue is the difficulty of reconciling Islam with modernity. More broadly, reconciling faith with modernity. We in the West had our own difficulties with that problem. The resolution that we reached, whether or not it was a good resolution, was in essence to marginalize religion so that individuals may still choose to believe, choose to worship a god, but as a practical matter, we've placed God on the margins of the way we govern our lives.
Yes.
It was a difficult process. It's a process that may not satisfy all believers in the West today, but it did enable us, I think, to move beyond religion as a source of conflict.
Well,
the sense is that that hasn't happened in Islam, and my further sense is that given the way that Muslims, the way that religiosity permeates politics in much of the Islamic world, that process of reconciliation is particularly difficult there.
But isn't it true that most Muslims have, to a large extent, synthesized modernity with religiosity, and that the ISIS fighters are really outliers when it comes to people of the Muslim faith? And it also seems to me that it would be tremendously beneficial to recruiting for ISIS were the West to make war on all of Islam, as some people like Donald Trump and others would have it. Wouldn't that play right into their hands?
It certainly would. That said, I'm not sure I fully agree with you about the extent of the reconciliation. I certainly would agree that First of all, Islam, like Christianity, like Judaism, is a faith in which a range of views exist. That said, there are very considerable populations in the Islamic world where resistance to modernity is pretty evident.
Right,
now,
right.
To your point, the number of Muslims who, in the course of for whom that resistance must take a violent form, mm-hmm. with violence directed in many respects against their fellow Muslims, but also in some cases against the West, the number of people who take up arms is relatively small. And in that regard, your point that anybody proposing to wage war on Islam itself is wrongheaded and is proposing something that is deeply counterproductive.
Yeah, certainly we would need to, as Confucius suggested, dig two graves. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive on this half of the show, we're talking with Professor Andrew Bacevich about what can realistically be done about ISIS. And as you put it, Professor Bacevich, quote, in this conflict, the West generally appears to enjoy the advantage of a clear-cut military superiority. I'm old enough to remember the same status being the case with a little and militarily weak country called Vietnam. We had enormous military superiority, and we lost that war. Today, the West, U.S., France, and England have unquestioned military superiority over the Islamic State. We could certainly flatten the entire region and make it radioactive for now until eternity. Is that enough to beat them? Is that at all realistic?
Well, obviously it's not.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty clear in the wars that we initiated in the wake of 9/11
mm-hmm.
that the presence of U.S. forces in places like in Iraq and Afghanistan, even if those forces were in all respects better armed than their adversaries, that the presence itself served as an incitement to resistance. We attracted the jihadists. We inspired the jihadists. Since we weren't willing to flatten the country and
right.
leave it a radioactive ruin, our putative military superiority was inadequate to the task. And my own sense is that for those who advocate a bigger war against ISIS, and in particular those who say that we need to send in U.S. and other allied ground forces, that it's quite likely that a similar outcome would result. That is to say that even if ISIS chooses to stand and fight, and even if we can reduce the threat posed by ISIS in a conventional sense, we will have a mess on our hands. And we won't be able to just sort of go in, clean out the rattlesnakes and then depart. We will find ourselves engaged in another occupation, which inevitably will turn out to be counterproductive.
And it seems to me, anyway, perhaps you have, I mean, being a historian, may have a different approach to this, but I'll put it out there anyway. It seems to me that we in the West have certain senses of history, certain understandings of history, and it appears that the Muslim world has a different sense of history and the impact on the realities of today. For example, to us, the Crusades are long forgotten, occurring 1,000 years ago, and World War I with the drawing of the Sykes-Picot line arbitrarily across the Middle East by the victors in the First World War, as the West's will was imposed on the Middle East. How do these seemingly arcane events affect that part of the world today? And I think that shows a very significant cultural difference. I mean, the idea of nations, of states, and as you describe, religiosity in their world. So how do these seemingly arcane events, the Crusades and the First World War, affect that part of the world today and what is being done to the West?
Well, I think for any people, an interpretation of history informs their understanding of the present, informs their understanding of who they are, of what they stand for, of what they stand against. And I think it's quite common for peoples, therefore, to remember selectively. They tend to remember old grievances that may not have been satisfactorily addressed, or they may choose to remember the moments of triumph and vindication. I think with regard to the United States, we choose in particular, I think, our history, the operative history, consists of a particular version of the 20th century as the American century,
right,
as the time when the United States achieved preeminence, and is the time when, in our recollection, however distorted this is, in the time when we became the exemplar of freedom and the liberator of others. I think that narrative centers on World War II,
yes,
which even today, I think, is the most important singular event in forming our self-definition. I mean, you've already made a couple references to Vietnam. It's striking how inconsequential Vietnam has become as an element in that preferred historical narrative. Vietnam doesn't fit.
Doesn't fit.
And
right.
So by and large, we choose not to remember Vietnam.
But what about, with your knowledge of the area, Professor Bacevich, things like the Crusades, and I saw many months ago there was a video of victorious ISIS fighters bulldozing through the Sykes-Picot line. Nobody's ever heard of that. I mean, what role in their history are things like the Crusades? And
I'm not competent to comment on the Crusades, but with regard to Sykes-Picot, as you suggested, World War I became the occasion for Europeans, the Western Europeans, our allies, Great Britain and France, to dismember the Ottoman Empire,
mm-hmm,
which up to that point, Great Britain had, as a matter of policy, supported up to 1915, 1916, the Great Britain wished to see the Ottoman Empire survive. When the Ottomans entered the war, the First War,
mm-hmm,
on the side of the Germans, British policy flipped, now committed itself to terminating the Ottoman Empire, and then, by extension, to carving up what we today call the Middle East, in order to serve the imperial purposes of Great Britain and France. Now, the United States had minimal direct involvement in that, but the Brits and the French proceeded to do so and in essence, created what we call the Middle East today, and as a consequence, created more than a few of the problems that are sources of great instability, with Iraq really as the preeminent example of that.
Yeah, Iraq was created in 1919 to 21 thereabouts, and the lines that were drawn didn't. The people on the ground weren't consulted in drawing the lines, certainly.
Of course not.
It was certainly imposed on them. Again, if you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Andrew Bacevich is our guest, a historian specializing in international relations, American foreign policy. He knows his stuff on the issues of which we speak. Now, French President François Hollande has launched a massive set of retaliatory strikes on ISIS territory. His anger, his rage is certainly understandable. You write that, quote, Hollande demonstrates a crippling absence of imagination, and that, quote, simply trying harder will not suffice as a basis of policy. All right, what could he do? What if he had a more of an imagination? And what else could Hollande do, given what happened to his country on November 13th?
Well, I mean, I would argue that France and anybody else in the West that is threatened by violent Islamic radicals, and that threat does exist, that the first obligation of government should be to continuously harden our defenses in order to try to prevent terrorists from successfully attacking us, even while acknowledge, and this is an important point, even while acknowledging that no perfect defenses can exist. So as long as the phenomenon of this anti-Western jihadism, justified or not, as long as it exists, there will be times when terrorism will succeed. And the purpose of the state should be to minimize those occasions, to limit the damage that can be done. That seems to me is priority number one. Priority number two, I think, is to recognizing that Western intervention into the Islamic world, with very few exceptions, tends to be counterproductive, tends to make things worse.
Yeah.
That we need to, and this is a huge diplomatic challenge, we need to find ways to get countries within that realm to assume responsibility for trying to restore some of the stability that we ourselves so recklessly destroyed, particularly by invading Iraq in 2003. In other words, the responsibility for restoring and then maintaining order should fall primarily on the shoulders of the countries that are there.
Well,
Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, they are better positioned to deal with the basic problem than we are.
And but their motivation may be different from ours. They have not been attacked as you know, France, England, and the U.S. have been.
That's not true. They have been attacked. They virtually all of them are threatened. I mean, the Russian airliner that was blown up the other week took off from an Egyptian airport.
Right.
So they do have an interest. I mean, they among themselves, they differ on a wide range of issues,
yes,
historical, religious, political, you name it. But my argument would be that those major regional powers all share one common interest, and that common interest is to maintain the existing state system to which ISIS poses a very direct and immediate threat.
So are they doing it?
No, they're certainly not doing a very effective job of it. And one of the reasons they're not, we reduce their motivation to do it, we the West,
mm-hmm,
because we the West continue to insist that it's Western military power that can fix the problem.
Mm.
And I think the present crisis with regard to ISIS manifests this in spades. ISIS poses a big problem. But why should the regional powers take on the very difficult task of setting aside their other differences in order to collaborate against ISIS when we've got the Americans bombing ISIS, we've got the British Prime Minister and the French President calling for war against ISIS? In other words, the powers within the region don't have an incentive to take on the responsibility of dealing with ISIS because Western powers continue to insist that the West itself will handle the problem.
Interesting. So we can't just, you know, sit back and do nothing. You suggest that, quote, rather than assuming an offensive posture, the West should revert to a defensive one, and that, another quote, rather than vainly attempting to police or control, this revised strategy should seek to contain. And Obama's taking a lot of heat for talking about containment. And before the Paris attacks, he had actually suggested that we had contained ISIS. Please describe what your suggested policy might look like and how it might actually achieve its goals.
Well, I tried to describe it already. I mean, that we harden ourselves, so we keep the bad guys from getting to us. We try to facilitate others with an interest in stability and assuming responsibility for that very difficult and challenging task. And I think thirdly also, this is very much on the margins, and the effects would take a long time to make any difference, but I think we also need to do what we can do in the realm of cultural exchange and educational exchange to encourage those forces within the Islamic world, you already referred to them, that are committed to reconciling faith with modernity. Right. That by connecting to those people, they tend to be young people, we can encourage them in their very difficult and challenging tasks.
So that's certainly more challenging and more complex than just going in and bombing the heck out of
I think that you're making a good point there, because the proponents of war, and the people who say, gosh, if we just send in 50,000 U.S. troops to take care of ISIS,
right,
it would be well, they hold out the promise of neat, tidy, easy solutions. The problem is that the historical record shows that the results are not tidy solutions, that the actual results first of all, they're exceedingly costly,
yes,
in terms of lives lost and money wasted,
yeah,
but that actually we end up making things worse. So what I have laid out is complicated. It doesn't promise a solution by tomorrow afternoon, but it seems to me that it's at least worth considering, given that the proponents of war who promise solutions have repeatedly been shown to be utterly off base.
Yeah, we have enough history of Western power intervention in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, South and Central America. It never works. It's only made things worse. And it seems like one of the possibilities to which you allude is possibly working with, say, Iran. There's domestic politics that we have to deal with, too. The idea of, you know, saying to the American people, yeah, since Iran is the enemy of ISIS, that maybe we should work with them and work even with Russia. That's a very... I wonder if, you know, having to appeal to domestic politics dooms the whole situation when there are other more reasonable, more effective alternatives. What do you think?
Well, you know, the domestic discussion of foreign policy is so deeply imbued with moral language that it becomes difficult to propose things that may be that morally may make you want to hold your nose, but that as a practical matter can actually produce morally desirable results. And I think you mentioned Iran, and I think that's a good question. It is a fact that Iran is not presently a liberal democracy, that Iran does not respect our definition of human rights, that Iranian senior leaders continually engage in rhetoric,
yeah,
anti-American rhetoric, anti-Semitic rhetoric, that we people rightly find offensive, but it's also considerable evidence, I believe, that Iran can be brought back in from the cold, been utterly isolated since the Iranian Revolution began 35 years ago, and that Iran can become a power that uses its influence to help restore stability. That, put bluntly, Iran is actually a status quo power, not a revolutionary power hell-bent on overturning the existing order. And so there is an argument to be made for trying to work with Iran, not because they're our friend, not because they believe what we believe, but because their interests in some very important respects coincide with our interests.
And there are a heck of a lot of young people in Iran, which is a huge, huge country.
Bingo.
Thank you so much. If people are interested in following your writing, to what website can you point them?
I don't have a website.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm a Neanderthal in Amsterdam.
Andrew Basevich, great stuff. Hope we can speak with you again at some point. Thank you so much for being with us and helping to keep democracy alive. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll be right back after this.